All right, good evening, welcome. Nice to see everyone here online and also in the room in person. All right, welcome. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. So we'll start with a 40-minute meditation, then take a short break for about 5 minutes, come back and offer a talk on the third noble truth, the truth of the cessation of suffering. A poem by Jane Hirschfield called Meeting the Light Completely. Even the long beloved was once an unrecognized stranger. Just so, the chipped lip of a blue glazed cup, blown field of a yellow curtain, might also, flooding and falling, ruin your heart. A table painted with roses, an empty clothesline. Each time the found world surprises that it is nature. And then, what is said by all lovers, what fools we were not to have seen. Meeting the Light Completely by Jane Hirschfield. All right, welcome back. All right, so we're going to explore this topic of the third noble truth some more. We did a talk 2 weeks ago and a recap last week, kind of looking at the more poetic way that this is expressed. I think that sometimes makes more sense than some of the details, the technical aspects of this third noble truth, which I'll explore today, but just to keep that in mind, that if this doesn't quite, feels like it's too many words, come back to just that, the heart inspiration of these poems and these utterances of those who are enlightened. So third noble truth is the truth of enlightenment, the truth of awakening, or the cessation of dukkha, the release of dukkha. And tonight I want to explore the four stages that we traditionally talk about and also the 10 fetters, which they're released as we go through. Now, the third noble truth is this truth of enlightenment or awakening or release of the heart. And the question is, what are we awakening from? You know, what's that awakening out of? What's the enlightenment out of? What is the heart being released out of? And it's really around ignorance and delusion. Ignorance and delusion, we can, you know, translate it either one, but I like to use them both because ignorance has this idea of not really understanding, not seeing. And delusion is the way we distort. We misinterpret the way things are. So we can't see things how they are. We're unaware of how things are. And we also misunderstand the nature of things. This is what we awaken out of in this tradition. This really relates to the three unwholesome roots that we talked about 2 years ago when we did a year on the threes. So there's greed, hatred, and delusion. And delusion, we can think of it as almost the core unwholesome root that greed and hatred flow out of. Because when we don't understand how things are, then greed makes sense. It makes sense to try to get mine and take it away from someone else. Hatred makes sense from that place of separation, that core interpretation or misinterpretation. And as we start to understand the nature of things more fully and more deeply, greed and hatred start to fall away. They start to just slough off us. And as they fall away, clarity grows. And as clarity grows, delusion decreases. And then more greed and hatred falls away. So this simple way I just described it is that the more clear we become, the more accurately we perceive ourselves and others, the more we're able to see through our delusions, our distortions. Naturally, greed and hatred start to fall away. And in that falling away, there's a quieting that starts to happen. There's more clarity that comes from that. That deeper clarity then leads to more of delusion falling away. This is basically just the process of awakening. We could just say that's enough for tonight. Go have a good rest of your evening. And you might wish that I had done that. This falling away, this dropping away, this falling away of the misunderstanding of the nature of things. So tonight I want to just go a little bit into the technical aspects, the way it's described, just to help you see the landscape. If you ever read the suttas or if you look at some of the other writings, it's just helpful to know what the landscape is. And also I don't want you to become a project for you. Like, okay, next week I'm going to get to the first stage, and then maybe 2 weeks later I can get to the second stage, and then I'll give myself a month for the third stage. That kind of leaning into it can backfire on us. There's also these 10 fetters that we want to explore. These are aspects to get released. But as I go through these, think of them all united through this common theme of dissolving ignorance and delusion. Because each stage represents a deeper falling away of ignorance and delusion, and also at the same time a deeper integration in our lives. I think those two really have to go hand in hand. That if our practice is really deep and transformational when we're in isolation, but when we go in to interact with others, with our loved ones, with strangers, it falls apart, then that's calling us to integrate it. And that's part of this whole process of integration. I think as lay practitioners, people who practice within jobs and relationships and children, in some ways we have an advantage because we're able to integrate our practice. We actually see, how does it show up when I'm having this difficult conversation? How does it show up when I'm dealing with painful news or the difficult situation in the world? So there's four stages of enlightenment as described in the suttas, and these are also called paths. Now the Pali word is M-A-G-G-A. MAGA, which isn't related to the other MAGA you might be more familiar with. We should try to take that word back. But I like this word path because it does imply a process. It implies a journey. It's not so much like you get your bachelor's and you get your master's and you get your PhD, these kind of endpoints. It's actually a process of deepening, of purification and integration that arises. There's an unfolding that arises. So it's less of a destination and more of a process. Now each of these stages of awakening or enlightenment are defined by two aspects. Right? Again, this is classically, the classic way it's described. One is the falling away of these fetters, and the other one is relationship to rebirth. All right, so let's get into the depths here a little bit. So let's explain these two. So fetters, what does it mean by fetters? These are these deep patterns of belief, of action, emotional, mental, energetic. These are the deep habits that often operate underneath the surface that we even realize that they're happening. Right? They kind of distort the way we see things, the way we show up in the world. It's almost like the riptides that keep pulling us along. We think we're going this way, but it's pulling us off to sea. And there's 10 of them that are included in this list. So four of the five hindrances that we're familiar with. Sleepiness isn't one of them, but you could argue that sleepiness is actually, or sloth and torpor, is another manifestation of delusion. And also the unwholesome roots. So these four, or these 10, I should say, are there self-view, doubt, belief that rites and rituals liberate, sense desire, ill will, craving for form, craving for the formless, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. Right, so we'll go into that. We'll unpack those a little bit more as we go through each of the four stages to kind of help us orient around what those mean. So that's one aspect. It's basically, we can think of that the big thing is a delusion, and that there's just different aspects of that that get highlighted, get seen through, and fall away. Sometimes they fall away completely, sometimes they fall away a little bit, and then more deeply later on. Okay, the other aspect is rebirth. Rebirth. Now, this is a little more difficult concept in our Western society. It's not part of what we believe. Other cultures, that's just part of the whole belief system. So it makes perhaps more sense. And honestly, rebirth, you know, kind of sounds like a good thing, right? You get a second chance or a third chance or a fourth chance. Sometimes at the end of a sutta where someone awakens, or they're describing their deep awakening into the full stage of enlightenment, there's this phrase that this is the last birth, never to be reborn again into this world. And sometimes I feel a little sad reading that. It's like, oh, you're not going to be able to come back. Yeah, from a Buddhist perspective, it's actually a good thing. And it tends to make more sense as our ignorance starts to fall away. The sense of rebirth, I think I'm going to just say from my own perspective, there is kind of a allure to it that, okay, I get to have another life. I get to be reincarnated. This is a common theme in our culture, just in your own lifetime, that we get to reinvent ourselves. We get to improve ourselves, go to, you know, a sense of transformation. The whole image of the phoenix rising from the flames. And yet, again, from a Buddhist perspective, it's not seen as a good thing. It's actually seen as a very painful thing to be reborn again and again. So two things to help explain this a little bit more. You can see why there's so much emphasis in the suttas, and especially in these stages of awakening, to get off this cycle of rebirth. It's also called samsara, the cycle of rebirth and of suffering. So one is coming from Hollywood, the Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. All right. So remember, if you've seen that movie, he's a reporter going to report on the groundhog popping up, and he's really kind of disgruntled, kind of burned out in his profession. And somehow something switches. He wakes up each morning back the day of Groundhog Day and just keeps repeating again and again and again. So at first he goes through being shocked by this, like, what is going on? He's testing it and he finally accepts it. Then he starts to delight in the fact that he can get away with anything. He can just, you know, he's talking to another actor and he's just eating, eating, eating. And she says, don't you worry about your weight? And he says, no. And he just, because he knows he's going to be reborn. Then he tries killing himself and he keeps getting reborn. And at some point he starts to feel the drudgery, you know, the difficulty of always having to be reborn again until there's some level of transformation. So this describes one aspect of this rebirth, the issue with it, is that it may sound enticing, but it does become very tiring, becomes very fatiguing. So from this is talking about, you know, one lifetime into another lifetime. We can actually see this in our own life, you know, just in this, how we, I like to look at it this way, that each lifetime we have many births and deaths. We arise and pass away. Right? And there's a reinvent. There's these bigger ways that it shows up, like these bigger life events. But even day to day, moment by moment, we're kind of rebirthing ourselves, and then also dying from that. And there's a lot of energy that has to go into it. It's a little bit like, Sisyphus. Say again. Sisyphus. Not syphilis, but that one. So as you know, he was condemned to keep pushing that rock all the way up. And then as soon as he got to the top, he had to roll back down. And this represents this fatigue, this exhaustion that comes. It's just constantly having to re-engage. And there's an energy that comes in as you start to practice more and more deeply. You start to see that there's energy that you keep adding into the moment to reestablish yourself, to judge the moment, to try to fix the moment. And as your practice deepens, at some point that falls away. And in that falling away, you realize there's such an ease to that. There's such a peace that comes from that. Okay, so that's a taste of this process of awakening. Okay, the second part, this is where the rub is, and this is, you know, maybe a little bit of a stretch for us. But from a Buddhist cosmology, there's different realms that we can be born into, right? So this human realm that we've all been born into is actually considered one of the best realms possible to be born into, because it has the right mixture of suffering and also ease. Okay, if it was just suffering, we'd be so busy trying to survive, so busy trying to just make one day to another. And then if it's too much ease, if things are just too, you know, just everything is, our needs are met so easily, we don't have the motivation to practice. So the suffering gives us the motivation to practice. We have enough ease not to be overwhelmed by it. Of course, there's a wide range of being human, that sometimes our ratio of suffering is really extreme, is very deep. Sometimes the ratio of pleasure is very deep. But there's these other realms. In particular, there's the realm of basically hell, where there's, you know, extreme pain and torturing. And some of the suttas describe it in a very vivid way. There's also the realm of the hungry ghosts. Okay, the hungry ghosts are these creatures which have really large bellies, insatiable appetites, but have a very small throat and mouth. So they can't possibly feed themselves. They're just always trying to eat and feed themselves. And then there's the animal realms. Okay, the animal realms are, they're so busy with trying to survive. They're trying to not to be eaten or trying to find something else to eat. So these three realms are considered their unfortunate births. And there's no guarantee that we won't be reborn into those until we start to move along this process of awakening. So you can take that how you will. You know, you may find that that's seems very compelling, or seems very worth believing, or you may be very skeptical. It's just, I'm trying to share that information, because that's part of the whole landscape if you start to study Buddhism. And it's also integral to how they define these four stages of awakening. Right? So again, as we go through these four stages, both the fetters start to fall away, and also the rebirth potential starts to change. So there's four stages. So there's stream entry, there's once return, once returner, non-returner, and then the perfection of the arhat. So let's look at these four stages and the fetters that are released. Okay, this first stage of stream entry is really the most critical. It's the most important for our own practices to understand, to really have deep insight into and to open to. So enough illusion and ignorance has fallen away. They're kind of like over the hill. There's kind of at this point, enlightenment is eventually guaranteed. They say that within seven lifetimes, you'll be enlightened. I don't know how they got seven lifetimes, but that's the way it's stated. This is often called, so it's called the stream entry. And because there's also, we will no longer be reborn in any of the three unfortunate realms. We won't be reborn in the animal realm or hell realm or the hungry ghost realm. Maybe just human realm or some of those higher ones. Now, the three fetters, I want to mostly focus on those aspects in this talk today. Is self-view falls away, doubt about the path falls away, and belief in rites and rituals that can liberate falls away. Okay, self-view. You know, we've been talking about this last week, and you know, I like to talk about it quite a bit. It's that sense of anatta, or non-self, that we see through this illusion of a sustained, ongoing sense of self. And I think a good way to think about it is not try to get rid of the sense of self, but just to try to understand it, to understand the nature of it. Because if we try to make a project of getting rid of the sense of self is trying to do that project. And it can be really frustrating when you're trying to find and get rid of the sense of self, and you look and look, and it's like it's doing this trick on you. Just every time you look, the eyes that are looking are actually the sense of self. So it's this really tricky thing that asks us to release in a very deep way some of the things we talked about 2 weeks ago. So self-view, that sense of an isolated self, it's tricky because there's this relative truth to that. There's a relative reality to it that perhaps many of us, as we're sitting here, that sense of self is really still very strong, very established. I'm having this experience. I'm having this thought. I'm cold. I'm warm. Whatever it might be, there's a sense of you having this experience, right? So there's a truth to that. And yet, if we look closely, and this is the tricky part, is we don't look closely enough to see that that sense of self arises and then it passes away to a new sense of self almost instantaneously, right? There's a new sense of self that's arising and passing away. And this insight or this fetter is this belief in it, and the fetter is the release when you see it clearly that there's not this solid sense of self, right? This is something that's is actually very attainable and possible for all of us. Sometimes we need to do a lot of practice, but sometimes it's more the intentionality and the willingness to look and the willingness to not believe what you think is true, to actually see through your beliefs, to see through your assumptions. You know, so this is a way just to be a good thinker that we do that. But there's also just being willing to that sense of self not be true, not to be continuous. Because, and this is hard because this is one of the basic foundations of who and what we are. We hear something and automatically we are the one who's hearing it. We're the ones who's smelling or thinking. It's like it's built in. It's almost like the operating system that loads up when you turn on your computer. So to be able to see underneath that, to see through that, does take some practice, some dedication, and some intentionality. Right? Sometimes a lot of meditation can help. Sometimes a lot of investigation can help. Sometimes seeing life in a certain way, having life kind of, having a big helping of dukkha sometimes can help. Because you just realize, wow, I can't go through this. That something has to fall away. Sometimes the beauty of nature, the beauty of birth, beauty of death can bring us into that. So doubt about the path. So in this fetter, is like there's this kind of skepticism. I'm not sure if this path really leads anywhere. I'm not really sure if this is going to actually, if enlightenment's really a real thing. I'm not sure if I can do this. And when this falls away, there's confidence. There's a complete confidence. That skeptical doubt falls away. It falls away. And the third aspect is that our beliefs, that rites and rituals can liberate. Right? So this one is a little bit more applicable perhaps in the day of the Buddha when there was a lot of people doing these very intensive practices with the idea that if I purify myself, if I do enough prostrations, if I do something sacred enough, then I will become enlightened. And this is seen through that those are just supporting. They're supporting aspects. They help to, you know, maybe train your mind, train the way you see, may purify yourself in different ways. But ultimately, that's not what liberates. That's not where it leads to liberation. Okay, so that's the first stage, stream enterer. And this is the most critical because once you have seen through that, when you really, you know, reach that or when that arises in you. And again, it's hard to say when you reach it because when this happens to you, you're not really, doesn't really make sense to claim it as you, if that makes sense. And that's how it often feels like, okay, I've got to become an enlightened person, which is kind of like a really shiny, polished version of me. You know, with all my bad parts gone, all my good parts out there, and a lot of new good parts, right? It's kind of that assumption. But that sense of ownership is really tied to this self-view. That's why it gets so tricky. It's a slippery one. It's a tricky one. But again, it's one that is, I think, very attainable with the right practice. So the first stage, once returner. And once that has arisen, you're basically, the suttas say, you're guaranteed to awaken within seven lifetimes in the deepest level. Okay, the next level is once returner. Once returner. So again, this is defined by kind of the rebirth, that you're going to be reborn one more time. And again, not in those lower realms, but might be in a human realm or even a higher realm. And the paths, each of these paths are cumulative. They build up. All the fetters that you did before continue to be released. So the first three have fallen away, and there's two more that start to become weakened. Okay, so this is an important. They become weakened. And I think it's helpful to note this, because sometimes we think, how can I ever get over my greed? How can I get over my ill will? But even at the first stage of awakening, there's still greed. There's still ill will. That's still part of this landscape of being human. And even on the second stage, it just becomes weaker. It becomes less of an influence, but it still is there. Not till the third stage does that fall away. So sense desire and ill will still are operating in different ways, but they're just much less charged. And the good news about this is we can start to practice this from day one of our meditation. We can learn how to start to recognize those patterns of greed. Greed is such a charged word, so you might translate that into kind of the wanting life to be a certain way, wanting things to be a certain way, or having yourself show up in a certain way. Or hatred can be that sense of pushing away, not liking, not to forget to include those aspects. And that's what we practice from day one. How can I just meet this breath, sit in the middle of this breath, notice how the mind goes this way, coming back? And you start to notice this in your practice, that your life starts to be transformed by that. You start to become less driven by those states. And it benefits people. It benefits everyone around you. So once returner. The next one is non-returner. So the non-returner is said to be destined for only one further birth at most, and this time only in those more subtle levels or formless realms, right? So this is getting a little more esoteric. So the two fetters of that greed and hatred, ill will, they were weakened in the last one, or once returner. Now they've really fallen away. They're gone. But there's still some fetters of craving for both form-based and formless meditative states. So this is interesting. And if you remember the ox herding pictures we did three or four years ago, those kind of talk about some of these different states, that we can have this hunger for some of the deeper meditative qualities. And these are talking about some of the jhanas, but we can also just see that desire for the stillness, for the quiet, that deep longing and hunger for that. That itself can be a little bit of a fetter that sets up a little bit of a potential for that next rebirth. And then finally, the last stage is that of perfection, or the arhat. So they've uprooted all the five lower fetters. And then they've also uprooted the higher ones. So this is craving for form, craving for the formless, conceit and restlessness, and finally ignorance. So let's explore these a little bit. And this one, of course, with the rebirth, you're not going to be reborn again. It's like there's nothing to be reborn. So that phrase, there's nothing to be reborn, one teacher was asked about what gets reincarnated. And he said, it's mostly your bad habits. Right. So it's like those bad habits is that momentum that comes back. So when those are completely freed, there's nothing to kind of form again into that sense of you. So again, we're looking at this from lifetime to lifetime, but you can see it from moment to moment. That times in meditation when you find, or just daily life, that you find yourself being completely still and connected to the present moment, notice how what comes after that is transformed by that. You know, sometimes it contracts back, like I want to reestablish myself. I remember early in my practice that I would meditate, I'd feel like a deep meditation, and then I wanted to open the fridge to kind of re-engage. I want to kind of get myself back together. So that's part of that momentum to come back. That's part of that fetter to come back. Other times that stillness, that falling away has a certain momentum that carries over into other parts of your life, maybe for a few moments or a few days or months. And you find that you just relate to life with a different quality, that you're still there having your responsibilities and relationships, and yet something is fundamentally shifted. Something is fundamentally fallen away. Right? There's not this same kind of hook that we get with other things, with patterns in our lives. So these other fetters from this last stage, so, you know, the first five stages, or first five fetters are part of that first three stages of awakening. Those fall away. But this last five takes some extra depth and intention and release. So the first two, the craving for form and craving for the formless, refer to the different blisses really of samadhi, of these jhana states, these trance-like states. So jhana states are a form of meditation, which is within this tradition. They're in the suttas all over the place. I'm not a jhana teacher. I haven't really practiced the jhanas. You know, you have access to them at different times, but it's not a big focus here at Seattle Insight. Other teachers really focus on that. And there's different levels of the jhanas. But basically, in a jhana state, your focus gets so steady and so sustained that everything else except that object falls away. There's a deep sustained quality. There's a quality of timelessness. And it feels pretty good. It's sort of a blissful state that arises from that. So samadhi, has these different depths and stages, and it's not something that's agreed with through all teachers. We could get 50 teachers in the room who teach jhana, and they probably would disagree about the different states. They'd say, no, that's not jhana. This is jhana. You know, and so there's kind of that that human element comes in. I think the important thing to remember as insight practitioners is that there's this axis concentration. That from that point, this is enough steadiness of attention, there's enough collectedness that you have a choice of going into jhanas or going into insight. And even the jhana side of things, the jhana camp says, you go into those, it helps you get more freedom from the hindrances, helps you get more really a quieter mind. But you have to come back to the access level of concentration to go into insight. Insight is what's going to transform. Insight is what's going to lead to liberation. So the craving for the form and the formless. So these are referring to those different levels of jhanas. There's formed ones and then formless, which have become more and more sublime. Now the next one is interesting. It's called conceit, but also called I just forgot the Pali name for it. What is the Pali name? Mana. Let's see. Yeah, mana. Good. Extra points. So mana is this conceit of self. All right. So conceit of self, what it means basically is you look out and you say, that person is much better than me. Or that person is much less than me. Or that person is the same as me. Does that sound familiar at all? It's kind of the basis of comparison and judgment. Now, did anyone ever struggle with that pattern? Do you ever get kind of hard on yourself that you still have that pattern? So this pattern doesn't fall away till the final stage of awakening. So give yourself a break. It doesn't fall away till the very last stage. Right? And this is an interesting thing because we talk about the sense of self seeing through it, but yet we still have ways the sense of self still operates. Till this very last stage. The sense of self is still having some greed, some hatred. right? We've seen through it, and yet it kind of reforms. So there's kind of this experience of being, you see, you know the reality of the lack of self, and yet there's still the energy that still keeps coming forth. There's still the wanting. You know, you're enlightened until you see the chocolate chip cookie, or you spend time with your in-laws. You know, there's a way that it reforms. And this is the subtle aspect of that sense of being better than, being less than, or being equal to. This sense of comparison. So be gentle with yourself. Don't expect that that's going to fall away. Doesn't mean we can't investigate it. We can't notice it. We can start to become aware of it. Okay, what does it feel like to be comparing better than, worse than? What does that energy feel like? But realize it's just a perception that you've laid upon the world, upon yourself. And when that falls away, then that really that sense of separation of falls away also. That falls away in a profound way. And this is something we talked about last week and the week before, some of the ways these poems express the awakened state often speak to that, falling away of separation. And then restlessness falls away at this stage. So it's not just the physical restlessness, but also the tendency of the mind to wander. Right? So isn't that interesting that this hindrance doesn't fall away till the last stage too? Right? That sense of body restlessness, the sense I can't quite sit still, the mental worry. So again, be compassionate for yourself. Be compassionate for that quality of the mind. You know, this was such a big secret of practice, is that the less we make our minds an issue and we're able to meet it with compassion, the problem starts to fall away. This is one of the things that when you start to have deeper insights around this, it's often kind of, I don't know if it's morbidly funny, but it's kind of funny that how much you've made it so hard. It's actually so easy. I just had to stop the argument. I had to stop fighting myself. I had to stop creating a sense of division with myself and my experience. And the final fetter that falls away is this deep root of ignorance. Right, so this is the deepest level. So I was trying to frame that all these 10 fetters are aspects of delusion. And then the final is that when it goes away completely, there's a complete release of that. And so when someone who's fully awakened, they live, they still they experience happiness and ease and enlightenment, but they can still experience the painful results of their past actions. You know, one of the more famous examples is the ex-serial killer, Agulimala, who had this project to try to collect 1,000 fingers from people he had killed. And he had 999, and the last victim was going to be the Buddha. And his encounter with the Buddha transformed him so much that he decided to become a monk and practiced. And eventually became an arhat, even though he had killed so many people. But people didn't forget that. They would throw stones at him and curse him. And they were so afraid and angry at the lives he had taken, the loved ones he had taken. So this is this interesting juxtaposition, that there's still this consequence of our actions. At one point, he's complaining to the Buddha about how everyone's so angry at him. And the Buddha said, just bear it. You just have to bear that. And that's that quality of, you know, sometimes we've done things in our lives which weren't so skillful, that caused harm. So even though we are no longer that person, there's still this willingness to bear the consequence, to still open to it. So these are a lot of words around awakening. I mean, I hesitate to go to so many words around it, because that can become this sense of a to-do list. Like, I want to get there. Like, if I have a punch card and I, you know, get my 10 punches, then I'm get a free meal or something. There's a way that our minds, our striving minds, engage. Right. So try to let your heart be what's that leads that. sense this sense of an aspiration and intentionality, this willingness to take your practice seriously. That's one thing that perhaps some of the rebirth stuff, when I first heard about it, I was like, I don't know if I believe that. But if it's true, it brings a little different urgency to our practice. It brings some urgency to pay attention, to be careful and kind in my actions. So letting the heart draw you forward. And in the homework, I put a few questions around this, kind of reframing this whole practice in a way that's hopefully more accessible. Just try to hold these simple questions in mind as you practice. Well, and those online, I put that in the chat, by the way. How can I act from wisdom and compassion? Right? Every time you feel this impulse to act, or as many times as you remember, how can I act from wisdom? How can I act from compassion? And then let that inform you. How is my own delusion and ignorance distorting the way I see myself in the world? How is my unconscious patterns, we can look at it from a psychological aspect, we can look at it from a Dharma aspect. They both start to intertwine. You know, how does my delusion distort the way I see myself and the world? And then finally, what is this nature of this sense of self? Not trying to get rid of the self or stop it, but to see the nature of it. When you see the nature of it, you see the emptiness of it. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. I'm going to read a final poem. This is from the First Free Women, original poems inspired by the early Buddhist nuns, by Marty Weinsgat. This one's called Mittakali, friend of the dark. I was always smart. If the path was good, I figured it would make me even smarter. One night while meditating, I watched my thoughts piling themselves up all around me. My mind built a house out of all those thoughts, then filled that house. Soon it was a whole city, a whole world. Oh, my beautiful, beautiful thoughts, who will look after you after I'm gone? I swear I could weep for all of you, my sisters. Do you really want to be free? Are you ready to leave behind all your precious little houses and make your home everywhere? It's not as hard as you might think. First, stand up, then walk out the door. So we have some time for any questions or sharing you might have around this topic or anything about the Dharma. Yes, Cheryl, up here in the front.
Being one whose mind is restless and worried probably 95% of the time.
Yeah.
Hearing tonight that it was one of the last things to go.
Yes.
I was like, oh, there's hope, and that... Also, that sense of compassion of, okay, this is a very deep-rooted fetter.
That's right.
And I understand now that possibly there are ways to work with it. But just recently I've been going, thinking that could get rid of it.
Yes, and that's, you know, like the earlier stages, like that sense of, you know, aversion starts to fall away. So we start to... And we practice with that mind state, okay, the mind of worry, the mind of restlessness. Okay, can let that simply be there. You know, stop mm-hmm. arguing with the fact that it's there. It's going to be there for a while. But what we can do is not have to get lost in it, not have to follow it, and not have to fight it, not have to create more judgment around it. So it just becomes, oh, the mind is really worrying right now. And the interesting thing is when you do that, what's observing that, what's sensing it, is actually outside of the worry. Mm. Right? You realize that, you know, are you really the worry? Are you really the mind who's restless? Or is there something that's able to notice that? If there's something that's able to notice it, that by definition means there's something observing it. Mm-hmm. Trust the part that's observing it. So this is a lot of what the practice is. We start to see different aspects of ourselves that we took as being me and mine. And we realize, oh, I'm able to see it. So re-emphasize, don't judge the fact that it's there or that it shouldn't be or there, but to really rest in the capacity to know it and just infuse that with compassion.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for sharing that. Any questions are fine. Don't feel like you have to have the perfect question or insightful question or a question that shows how wise you are. You know, just the honesty. This is how we are together. We're learning how to find our way through. Okay, Kathy, go ahead.
Thank you, Tim. What an interesting talk. And my question is something like, is this written out somewhere where you can read it? I could read it?
Sure. You know, actually, I did a search on Four Stages of Awakening, I think. And one of the sites that came up that I used as a reference is from Spirit Rock. It was like a, reference or resource for one of their retreats, like maybe a couple years ago. If you have trouble finding it, let me know. I can share it with you. But that's that kind of laid out, you know, this whole process and these different levels of awakening. There's different suttas, you know, pull them out. Sometimes the suttas are a little bit more bare bone as they explain it. And part of the reason for that is a lot of the suttas actually just talk about the absence in terms of describing awakening as like it's non-clinging or it's non-attachment or it's, you know, even the word nibbana is not like, you know, enlightenment. It's like the blowing out, the quenching. Because the mind's going to tend to want to, it's going to really be enticed by the positive descriptions. But if they focus on the negative descriptions, it helps you say, okay, it's not anything I can think of. It's nothing I can conceive of. And so that's one of the reasons why they tend to do that. But that's a good resource that I found.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, actually, let's get Valerie first, and then she was quicker on the draw. And then we'll get you to Leslie.
Thank you so much for the talk. I was wondering if you could help explain a little bit more about these stream entry phase where the self-view starts to fall away and the non-returner where the jiva, avijja, and the disillusionment completely falls away. Could you help distinguish the two?
Between the first and second stage or
the first and third?
First and third stage. All right, let's... Sorry, I was...
In regards to the self-view.
Talking about self-view, yes. Having my big picture on the screen. Okay, the difference between the first and third aspects. Yeah, so the first stage or the stream entry is like there's this kind of deep insight into the nature of non-self. Now you see that it's no longer, you see it's like this illusion. It's almost like this kind of threshold that we cross over that from on one side of the threshold, it's really scary to contemplate not having a sense of self. Because who's going to be doing this thing I call Tim or my Valerie or whatever my role is? It doesn't make, can't conceive of it. And it doesn't. It's like it's really almost a way of a death of the ego or a death of that sense of self. So this is often we feel that sense of fear that arises in meditation. That if we're sitting and we're just feeling very still and part of it is like, ooh, I don't know if I like this. I'm not sure if I'm not defined right now. I don't know who and what I am. It's like this existential fear that's on this one side of it. On the other side of it, though, it's like you realize, okay, that wasn't such a big deal because there's still this consciousness, there's still this awareness, there's still this knowing of all my, I don't like I forget how to open my car or my house or anything. I know how to do all those things. There's just not the identification as that is me who's having that experience. You know, that kind of makes sense. And there's this sense of interconnection that arises from that. Now, with that stage, there's still some of that quality of you have greed and hatred that arises. That's where those still fetters are just getting weaker. But at that first stage, they're still kind of intact. So it seems like a paradox, right? Because if that really falls away, who's going to be greedy and who's going to be, having hatred? And it might be, you know, this kind of clear distinction of one to another, you know, may not be such a good service for us. It's probably more of this kind of continuum, this process, that probably realistically there's some ways that we open in one area and other areas we're not quite so open to, and we have to integrate that. But it's basically there's this, you can have this deep understanding, this deep knowing, and yet you forget. You kind of forget that it's true. Or you get triggered, you're on the wrong or right situation, and that sense of self is like right there. And even there though, it's not quite believed in the same way. There's almost this kind of whispering behind you that you still kind of know that it's not completely true. Another way to describe it is when you have these deeper understandings into non-self, it becomes like a compass that's pointing to north, right? So north, you know where it is. You can always find it. You get really disoriented, but you can, if you listen to it or look at the compass or sense into it, oh yeah, that's still there. And so then the third stage, that falls away, you know, especially the greed and hatred, that energy to dislike, to push away, particularly around that sense of me who's having that greed or that hatred. There's still preferences, like there's still, I'd rather have this versus that, but there's not that way it forms into the identification. So we can say it's a deeper form of that non-self being realized. And it also speaks to just the momentum of these unwholesome roots, that they're very strong in us. They're very strong currents. And I think it's, you know, one thing I hope you get from this discussion is that some of these patterns, we get so judgmental of ourselves. It's like, wow, I'm still having greed. I've been practicing, you know, for 2 months or 20 years or 30 years. I'm still having this greed and hatred. I'm still having a restless mind. I'm still doing comparison. It's like, oh yeah, these are part of this pattern of being human. And it takes a while to see through those. Right? So that's why it's actually encouraging to shift if from those patterns being problems and more something to understand and turn toward. And the more personal you take them, the more that sense of self is established, the harder it is to turn toward them because it like reflects upon who you and what you think you are. When that is more softer, that sense of self is thinner, it's easier to make it as, this is interesting. Let me actually use it as an opportunity to understand the nature of my suffering more clearly. Does that kind of get to your question a bit?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Valerie. All right, let's go to Leslie, and then we'll go to Nina next.
This is a great talk today. My question is sort of simple. I just would like a less loaded way to think about delusion and ignorance.
Yes.
If there's different words you use or different definitions.
Yeah. Delusion and ignorance are kind of heavy words, and it's easy not to kind of have judgment come up in response to them. I tend to think of it more as simple, you know, confusion, you know, not seeing things how they actually are, you know, the nature of that. And that's kind of the nature, one of the ways I often think of in insights is that you see things more clearly how they actually are. It's like, oh, it's like you're kind of like, before that insight arises, there's kind of this closed loop that you just, everything makes sense from that place of assumptions and beliefs. And then at some point you kind of see through that and you realize, oh, that was just a belief. That wasn't very accurate either. So there's like this stepping back and seeing more clearly. That's kind of that clarity. That's the falling away of that, the delusion.
Kind of like a curtain.
Yeah, like a curtain. Yeah, I can think of it that way. You know, so because it sometimes does have this power of a curtain, or maybe like a heavy fog that just kind of, you can't quite see anything. And sometimes you see through it. It's like, oh, I can see the mountain now. I can see the lake. I can see someone else. And the fog comes back. And, you know, just being, you know, kind to that doesn't fall away completely till the last stage. It gets looser. It gets softer. And that's how, if our practice is, if it's really on the edge, when we're really the working edge, there's delusion there. Like we're working with the delusion. If we stayed really completely in our clarity, our practice isn't deepening. Yeah, so, I mean, I love it when students are confused and they don't know what's going on, because it's like, okay, they're on the edge of that. And often you can maybe help guide them to see more clearly, or ask questions or point certain ways, and then they see in a different way, and something falls away. That's the falling away of delusion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. All right, Nina.
Thank you, Tim. This is a great talk. In many ways, you've answered what I've thought it was, because I was still, and it's just from my conceptual mind, was like, okay, so then where is the connection of the third noble truth? And I had a problem, you know, just, it was like I was skipping then. And then I realized that, I'm realizing that what you're saying, that the fetters are what we suffer from.
Yes. Yes, yeah, you could say that dukkha, the process of the first and second noble truth, ultimately is the process, the active process of dukkha, or active process of ignorance and delusion. Yeah, it's just that not seeing clearly, that misinterpretation.
Right, so then the third noble truth is our recognition of these fetters and hindrances, maybe, and that they can be eliminated.
Yes, I mean, you could say that there's the recognition of them. You know, that's often where I think we all have to start, is to really start to see them, to observe them, because that observation means we're not lost in them. You know, we're not acting from them. We're actually perceiving, oh, there's this state of greed happening, or aversion, or, you know, just me being cranky, or me being identified and thinking I'm right and you're wrong, or whatever it might be. All those. It's like that seeing of that, that means you've stepped back and you're observing it. You're not so lost in it. That's starting to loosen the whole process. And then at this, in terms of the third noble truth, something, because we can observe it and sense it for a long time, but at this, when we get to the third noble truth, something falls away. Something releases. And it's probably better to say it releases from us versus we release it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we try to release it, it tends to be aversion trying to get rid of something, or craving trying to get somewhere else. It's like I have a stick sticking in my hand, I'm like pushing and it keeps sticking someplace else. But it's more like this complete allowing of this. You see it so deeply and you stop any argument with it. And you've also stopped kind of re-upping it. Because that's a big piece of it too, is that these patterns, because they have so much momentum and energy, they tend to reinforce themselves. And if we're unconsciously reinforcing it, they become more and more gripped. But when we start to observe it, we stop reinforcing it, and it starts to become lighter. It's like the root system becomes less and less established. And then at some point, it falls over, it releases from us. And so it's not, you know, one teacher described it, one nun actually described it as sitting under a tree with a fruit that's ripening, and you wait for the fruit to fall into your lap. It falls when it's ripe, when it's ready.
Yes, thank you. That's helpful for me to see that direct connection on the both sides. And I feel that I've experienced that, and most recently about, you know, I was just ruminating about this habit, this habit thinking that I kept having. And then after I said, well, let me look at this. And then I was able to have compassion for myself for thinking about it. And that released that mind state.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that moment of moving that trajectory you just described, that struggle with the mind state and the pattern, not wanting to be there, and finally you turn toward it with compassion, that can really turn toward it with a really full-hearted compassion or sincere compassion. There's a way that arguments, you know, you stop trying to get rid of it. You're listening to it. You're actually connecting with it. And then that's the paradox, is then it releases from us. Yeah,
thank you so
beautiful.
Much.
Thank you for sharing that, Nina. All right, anyone else? Okay, so Kathy and Jusli put that in there. Or Jusli put that in there. All right, Jusli, go ahead.
I am resonating with that last question and answer because I think that's been up for me. We had the BIPOC group yesterday, and the question that came up for me, just a curiosity, is like, I can in the moment be very aware of dukkha, like okay, I get that, but it's harder in the moment to be aware of the release. And so I have like a curiosity around that, if there's like, I guess what I can touch is more of that retroactive mindfulness of like, okay, it played out, and then if I look back, then it's like, okay, something's different, or maybe something shifted, but I'm noticing that, like, yeah, like I don't know that flavor of in the moment noticing the release. And I'm thinking of, well, sometimes in the suttas, it's like, okay, pay attention when, for example, a hindrance is there and when it's not there.
That's right.
But that seems to be like a little, like, flash of, okay, is it absent or is it not absent? But release seems different for that. Release seems like it's like there's a, like a movement there, and I don't know. I was just kind of curious about that. The in the moment, their noble truth, or maybe that's not a place to inspect. I don't know.
I think it's. I think you're onto something. I think that's a good thing to notice, because when we're dealing with something, we're trying to release, we're trying to work with a hindrance or with dukkha. It's like we really have a job to do, right? We can really kind of roll up our sleeves and get engaged and struggle with this and try to see through it and try to have compassion for it and all these different qualities. But it's often, if we look back, there's a little bit of a sense of you who's doing, having the project. And this is part of this deeper level of, back to the second noble truth of Tanha, this is that hunger to have a job to do, hunger to... Have you read that poem by Naomi Shihab Nye called So Much Happiness? When she talks about how, I'm going to try to paraphrase it, that when with sadness, you have something to do. You have pieces to pick up and something to put back together. But happiness, it just floats. There's nothing, it doesn't ask anything of you. And there's that kind of that hunger to do something. And sometimes it can be really interesting to tune into that quality. And how that, on one hand, it's really helpful for us, right? It helps us kind of start to cut through this level of delusion and to see things more clearly and be more skillful in our lives and to show up and meditate and bring ourselves back. I mean, there's a way that has to be really, that's really helpful. It's like the positive sankharas that lead to release, to a deeper deepening of our practice. But at some point, that sankhara itself, or the volitional activity or the intention to do something, that creates a little bit of me doing it, of me being involved with it. And so sometimes that's an interesting edge. You know, when there's a quietness and a stillness, okay, what is the absence of that? Can I feel that hunger? Imagine if that wasn't there. That can sometimes elicit a lot of, well, I don't know who and what I am. And then you know, okay, that's going the right direction. And then you can be at that level for a while. At some point, for myself, it was helpful just to imagine, not so much imagine, but sense, what am I releasing into? You know, because there's sometimes, okay, I'm releasing the dukkha, but what am I releasing into? And that was somehow comforting for this mind and this sense of self, that okay, I can release into the stillness, into the quiet, into the quality of awareness itself. Does that kind of get to your question around releasing?
Yes, thank you, Tim.
All right, thank you, Tisley. All right, anyone else? Oh, go ahead, Emery.
Hi. Thank you so much for this talk, and also to everyone for their really helpful questions. It's just so great to hear other people, like, their struggles and their questions and everything. So, Tim, you and I have talked a lot before about the navigational self.
Yes.
And there are definitely times when I'm quiet or meditating or taking a walk by myself, even, you know, maybe many days a week, where I feel that thinning of self. You know, I feel much less formed and much more of like a mysterious source of knowing that's, you know, bigger than just Emery. But then what I find really challenging is, you know, I have this navigational self, and this navigational self has a lot to do every day. And when I'm doing, and I'm focused on doing and tasks and accomplishing and what's next and so forth, that bigger sense, I would even say, like, yeah, just that the mystery is gone. It's just like, and, you know, I spend a lot of time in that navigational self, and I'm tired of it. Like, I'm so over it that I feel like it's really hard to put down, because it feels like the responsible part of me that does the things I'm supposed to do. So I don't know if you have any wisdom, or if I just need to, like, quit my job and kick my kids out of the house and move to a cave.
Yeah, that's often the reason people do that. They realize there's so much, you know, there's a phrase with when someone goes forth, becomes a monk or a nun, there's kind of this, you know, the householder life is so cluttered, so dusty, and there's the renunciate life is kind of free and open. And it's part of, like, that release of those patterns. Of course, then you get into the monastic world and you realize there's still people here you have issues with, and you know, you have all these other things to do, so it's not as open as it might be, but it's certainly more open than normal life. But I think the important thing is to realize that this is part of the integration, right? So when you're basically, nothing's demanding of you, you don't have anything you have to do, you can just relax into that quality of that stillness and that openness and that thinning of that sense of self. And so now the integration is, how does that come forth in the midst of having a lot to do, you know, the busyness of life? And that's part of that deeper process of integration that we have to go through, that we can, because we can't just stay in this, most of us can't just stay in this state. We have families, we have jobs, we have responsibilities. But the good news is that taste that you feel that you have so much access to when you're not having demands on yourself, start to interpret that as more the trueness of who and what you are. You almost think of it as, I don't know if the compass analogy works, but it's like you're really getting a sense of which way is north. You really can sense it, you know, feeling it in an embodied way. And start to just float with that idea of, you know, where is that sense of me, you know, and notice how it's much softer, much thinner at that time. Okay, now then you're middle of your to-do list and you're all your responsibilities in it and chores, the heaviness of that, you know, the conflicts and the problem solving and the dilemmas. in the midst of it, see if you can periodically just kind of refresh that compass, saying the it's still valid. The north is still there. Mm-hmm. And one question you might ask is that, you know, okay, I got to write this report. I've got to do this thing with this person. Ask yourself, who is doing this? Where is that sense of me who's doing it? And it could just take a few seconds to call that forth and notice where that sense of self isn't. By asking where, you know, who's having this experience? Who's upset right now? Who's worried right now? And that brings, it reminds you back into that true north that comes forth. Because basically the task is how can I, if it's not really a task, but how can I still be an engaged human being and still understand that nature of non-self? And by doing that, you can find that, okay, I'm still doing this, but it doesn't kind of keep looping back and reinforcing that sense of me. So it would become lighter, become less strong, and then eventually you'll be able to say, I can do that without, for some things, you're able to do it without it really being engaged. And there's this interesting paradox, is how is Emery, the non-self Emery, engaging with this to-do list, this task? And, you know, I know the kind of nature of your work a bit, you know, working with people, that's a beautiful time to practice it. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, can I really show up and be present?
That's very helpful.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so we've come to the end of our time tonight. So I want to thank everyone, as Emery echoed that, hey, your questions really help us all learn about the Dharma. We're exploring this together. It's mysterious. There's struggles. But it's something that we, you know, our engagement is really what brings it alive. And that's the power of Sangha. And also, I'll just thank all the volunteers. So thank you all. This is, it's amazing we can have such a wide range of geographic locations all coming together. They help support us all hearing the Dharma. So thank you all for that support. And thank you all for your practice.